So, hi Gamal, hey. Welcome to the No Shortcuts podcast. Thank you so much for being our very first guest. We were very excited when we got the email to say that you would do it. So
the pleasure is all mine. Thank you very much for having me. Really good to see you both.
Yeah, absolute pleasure to have you here. I'm sure many people who are watching us will recognise you. But yes, as you know, the No Shortcuts podcast is about like charting the journey and the challenges and the hurdles that people have overcome to get to where they are. So yeah, it was kind of telling the behind the scenes of the story of success. So yeah, delighted that you are our very first guest. So I thought we could start with, obviously you moved from Sierra Leone to the UK at the age of 3, and then we later settled in Somerset. What I'm really interested to know is, how did that early experience of moving from one culture to another shape your perspective, like from a personal and professional perspective?
Yeah, I think in many ways, you know, I'm from a generation that It's from two different cultures. You know, I've got my strong West African culture, which I'm fiercely proud of. And I always say, you know, my dad's Liberian, my mom's Sierra Leonean, and I always say I'm proudly Sierra Leonean and Liberian, I'm proudly West African. But I'm also proudly English and I'm proudly British. And I think, you know, if I think about, you know, my journey through life, it, in some ways there have been sort of challenges because, you know, over here I say, you know, I'm an African man, I'm proud, I'm also British. Yeah. But I found times, you know, going back to Sierra Leone and Liberia, you kind of go back there and people are like, "You're English." I'm like, no, I'm African. It's like, no, you're not, mate. You're English. Yeah. You know, listen to how you sound and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, so I think from an early age, I was always very aware of identity and my personal identity. And, you know, I wore this kind of suit of armor whereby nobody would ever let me feel that I wasn't something that I wasn't something that I believed I was.
Yeah.
So that was my identity. You know, I'm proudly British. I'm proudly, you know, West African, and nobody can kind of shake that from me.
Yeah, of course.
And that's always given me a real kind of sort of a focus. And I think having that identity and just being aware of that, you know, from your formative years as you get older, it's really important because it kind of keeps you on a path and helps you keep you on a trajectory, you know, and it gives you that confidence.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, as you develop and you progress and you get, you know, more and more successful through life, there are always going to be people that want to, you know, pull the rug from under your feet.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and I think if you can kind of maintain that identity, those fundamental belief, you know, the ethos that I have about myself, you know, that keeps me on track and that keeps me moving forwards.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, that kind of leads us on to the other question, really, like the importance of patience and hard work.
Yeah.
You know, I know that, you know, you've done various different things before you became a journalist and a TV presenter. Just to give everyone a bit of perspective on how it works, does it take as long as it looks to get to where you are now? Years of hard work?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a long-term project, and I think that's what youngsters got to be aware of about a career. You know, there are no real shortcuts. You know, I decided I wanted to be a journalist, you know, when I was maybe about sort of 23, 24 years old, and I got my first job in journalism when I was 25 years old. And in that time, you know, you do the school of hard knocks, you do the long hours, you make lots of personal sacrifices. It's just, you know, the thing that has to be done. And I think there is an acknowledgement and a self-awareness that if you know where you want to be, if you know where you want to get to in life, then you need to be prepared to do the hard stuff in between. And it's a long, long, ongoing process, and you're never the finished article. And I think, you know, telling yourself that in those early stages, in those early years, and what I say to a lot of the youngsters who I mentor now is that you need to be a sponge. You need to work in different areas, work with different people, and learn as much as you can, and put the hours in.
Yeah.
You know,
including the coffee runs.
Including the coffee runs. Including, but that's so important because
the first
newsroom that I worked in was a radio newsroom.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was an internship that I did, a placement, and there was an expectation that the runner, which I effectively was, did the teas and coffees.
Yeah.
You know. And you know, I can understand people saying, well, you know, that's not your job, that's not what they brought you in to do. But ultimately, if you're the person making the teas, you're also the person handing the teas and coffees over to different people, and of course, you're having those conversations. Yeah. They're asking, you know, you about you, yourself, like what you're doing, and you're asking them about their jobs, and it's an opportunity for you to mix and an opportunity for you to interact, you know. But I worked a lot of, you know, what we in the business call like the graveyard shifts, you know, working late at night. You know, I remember my first job, you know, at Granada, you know, for months and months and months, it felt like it was forever. I was on the late producer shift. So you start your day at 2 o'clock and you finish at, you know, 11 o'clock at night. And I was doing that for months. So I wasn't kind of seeing my friends, I wasn't seeing my family in the evenings, but I knew that, you know, I'm not going to be doing this forever, but it's a step in the direction that I want to take, you know, and I think that is, you know, one of the most important things, you know, is having an idea where you want to be, where you want to go, and that kind of helps the daily grind.
Yeah.
You know, because you say, okay, do you know what? I can take the hit. I can work extra hours. You know, I can work this weekend when all my friends and families are out having a party and all that kind of stuff, because I know that ultimately I'm going to get to where I want to go.
Yeah, it's the bigger picture, isn't it?
This will be a distant memory.
Why did you want to actually go into journalism, though? That's the biggest question.
Yeah, so, I mean, I came late to the industry. You know, I think if you speak to a lot of, you know, journalists, you know, they'll say to you, you know, I wanted to be an intrepid reporter from the day I was, like, you know, the day I could walk and all that. And, you know, I was wearing dungarees and things like that, and always had a really keen interest in, you know, telling stories and things like that. But honestly, you know, if I'm being completely frank with you, it came later on because, you know, I went to university, I did an arts degree, you know, I did politics and history. I didn't know what I wanted to do, you know, so I stayed on to do a master's in international politics. And then it was off the back of that, you know, that I thought I was actually going to go into policy, you know, sort of governmental work, you know, work for like NGOs, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I think coming from like an international political background, which is what I studied, you know, that was the area that I thought was going to be for me. So I worked for a couple of different think tanks. One of them was called the Commonwealth Policy Studies Unit, and then I worked for another think tank called Chatham House, and I worked in the Africa program because African politics was one of my specialisms.
Okay.
And it was during that time working at Chatham House where you'd hold these round table meetings, and there were journalists from all around the world and discuss, along with, you know, sort of political figures, academics, and they'd come and share their stories and share their opinions. Yeah. And a lot of it was, you know, Chatham House rules, and you can kind of be, you know, disclose, you know, after the meeting. But it was just fascinating, you know, just being in a room with these different people from different backgrounds and different countries, you know, talking about their experiences in journalism. You know, somebody working in Milbank in London, their experience of being a journalist is going to be very different for somebody who is from Uganda.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I just found it amazing. You know, and you know what I really kind of learned from them was that it was so important to be able to give a voice to the voiceless and give people who don't have the opportunity to have a platform, that platform.
Yeah.
And even if it is, you know, they're featuring in a 2-minute report, you know, they are having the opportunity to have their say and to talk about their experiences and to share their experiences and to raise awareness. And I think it just blew me away. And I was just like, you know, work my strengths, work my weaknesses.
Yeah.
You know, I like people. I like meeting people. Yeah. I like conversing, you know, and I like telling stories. And off the back of that, I was like, yeah, this is absolutely for me. And that's what really made me want to become a journalist. And, you know, I look back and, you know, there are different paths that you can take because, you know, I had friends that did economics. You knew that they ended up going into the financial services sector. I had mates who did medicine. You know, they're going to be doctors, dentistry, so forth, so on and so forth. You know, but for me, there were kind of different options and different paths that I could have taken. Yeah. But I took journalism and I haven't looked back.
Fantastic. I think one of the questions I was thinking about was obviously you have kind of reported in high stakes situations. Mm. You know, what are some of the most difficult moments you've experienced up in the field, and how have they shaped your understanding of resilience and things like that? Because they can't be, you know, I watch the news, I, you know, the news, I'm not a geek, but it's one of my favourite things to watch. But I do often think when I see certain stories, like what we're seeing with certain issues that are currently happening around the world, that can't be an easy job to be reporting from places where people are going through all kinds of horrendous atrocities. You know, I'm just curious, you know, what is that like for you?
It's hard. It's hard. You know, I can give you a couple of examples off the top of my head. You know, we had the Southport stabbings.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, because, you know, everything that we do, when we go into every single day at ITV News, it's about people, you know, whether it's about our viewers and whether it's about the people that we speak to. People, people, people. Yeah. It's fundamental to everything that we do, you know, and we have a responsibility to get things right, to get stories right, to get our facts right for people.
Yeah.
Because because for us, you know, you're doing a 2-minute, 3-minute report, or you're doing a program for half an hour, you know, if you're working on a story that is extremely emotive and it's a hard-hitting story and there's a person who is involved in that story,
yeah,
and you get it wrong, you make a mistake, whether it's legally or, you know, you get your facts wrong, that will affect that person from now until God knows when.
Yeah, of course.
You know, so we have a responsibility to get these things right and to be sensitive and to treat these subjects with, you know, empathy and sensitivity. Yeah. And I think, you know, the Southport stabbings was one of those kind of stories that it just really hits you because these are kids.
Yeah, the children.
These are kids, you know, and we will have kids of our own, or we will have family members with kids, we'll have friends with kids, and you just can't get yourself in the mindset, you know, of how this can happen to innocent, the most vulnerable people in society. And kind of being there, there's a real energy that you feel.
Yeah.
And if it's a feel-good, positive story, you feel that feel-good, positive energy. But if it's a heartbreaking, gut-churning story, then you feel that.
Yeah.
And that tension in Southport was palpable.
Yeah.
You know, you get into that community, you know, where the attack happened and it's all cordoned off, you know, apart from an area where, you know, people can come and leave flowers and leave cards and teddy bears. You feel it and you feel a real weight at, you know, and it kind of does weigh you down. You know, we're there for the best part of 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, doing live presentation from Southport, you know. And it's hard, but I think what we try and do is you kind of try and compartmentalize it and say, we've got a job to do, we are professionals, you know, we will deal with it as a team and individually, you know, once we are off air.
Yeah.
But right now, we have a job. And, you know, I think if anything positive out of that story, I would say was that, you know, when we were coming off air, you had people from the community coming out of their houses and thanking us
for
how we treated the story and how we covered the story and how we were sensitive and how we weren't sensationalizing.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean by we are so aware of the responsibility, you know, that you go into every single day, you know, telling each other as colleagues, as a team, that we have to get this right.
Yeah.
It's really, really important.
Do you feel that the tensions change, though? You know, like for the first 3 days or 4 days that you were there, to later on in the week, do you think that people start to think, wow, you know, this shouldn't have happened because of this.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have happened because of that. Where initially the first report was like, this has just happened.
Yeah.
It's a massive tragedy.
I think initially, you know, that it's almost like kind of sort of different stages of grief, isn't it? You know, there's the initial just like shock.
Yeah.
And then it begins to sink in for people. And you know, people, you know, so we were at a live point by where people were putting down tributes and stuff. And the only voices you could hear, you know, for the 2 weeks that were there was actually reporters who were sort of talking, you know, to each other, who was, you know, who would be on the phone to colleagues who were in the newsroom. You know, there was just a stunned silence there.
Wow.
You know, and that was there. And, you know, for the vast majority of people, the only, you know, knowledge they will have of Southport is a place where you might go on holiday.
Yeah, of course.
You know, but like now, the minute you say to somebody Southport, it's got completely different connotations.
Yeah. Well, I saw something on the news, as it happened a week ago, and I was talking to a couple of the council guys who were saying that people visiting Southport now, it's down 85%. Nobody actually goes there now.
Yeah.
because it's associated with one with the deaths and obviously with the rioting and stuff. So the local restaurants and bars are really suffering because no one wants to go there.
My colleague Anna Connor did a piece on it about, you know, the effect on businesses. But, you know, it's a remarkable community. It's a resilient community. Yeah. We saw that. And, you know, you saw the atrocious riots that took place, but also you saw a community rallying together and saying, you don't speak for us, this is nonsense, get out of our town, get out of our community, we have nothing to do with you know. So that gives me hope that this is a community that will bounce back. I have no doubt, you know, but it will take time. And I think for us, you know, one of the big challenges that we face is, you know, how long do we have a presence there you know, before the community say, do you know what, just leave us to it.
Yeah.
We kind of need to move on.
Yeah.
And that's one of those big editorial decisions that you need to make. But equally, as regional news, you know, whilst all the kind of the national, the network, you know, news organisations, they come and then they go, we still need to have a presence there.
Yeah.
You know, because Southport is part of the Northwest.
Yeah, of course.
Southport
is
part of our wider community. So we need to make sure that we are there, you know, at every step, you know, doing what we can to give Southport a platform in order for it to kind of rebuild itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I must admit that, you know, that really affected me, and I'm sure it's a case for a lot of people. But, you know, I think it was the riots. That's actually probably one of the first times in recent years where I've actually thought about, actually, do I want to leave the house?
Yeah.
Do I want to go?
Well, we had that conversation, I said to you,
Len had an event here, and I had to message Len and say, look, you know, I always come and support, but I just didn't feel comfortable going out over that period of time. And even now, like my mum, for example, my mum is still a bit nervous about going out. She won't come into the city centre after a certain time because she's just a bit scared.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really interesting how, you know, there was so much fallout from that. But for me, it was that thing. I remember consciously thinking, I had a meeting in the city centre not long after it happened, and I was literally scared to leave my house, which is just really sad, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I often think about Southport and think, you know, how are they coping and how will they continue to cope in the aftermath of what's happened? It's just, it was such a sad time.
I mean, professionally, you know, the riots, again, like, you've almost got to have two caps on. You know, you've got your professional cap on, you've got a job to do, you know, which is report the events on the ground. But as a man of colour as well, you're just like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
You know, and you had these, you know, people on the streets shouting, you know, I want my country back, I want my country back.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, I want my country back, you know?
Yeah.
And it's one of those, you know, these... They're a small, loud minority, you know, and I think that's what I was telling myself, like, every day when you're reporting on the riots, you know. The vast majority of people just do not think like that, you know. And they were a small but very vocal minority, and they will crawl back under the rocks where they came from.
Yeah. Thank God for that.
Yeah.
One of the things I was thinking is that, you know, obviously the going back to the rioting, the information that they were fed was obviously incorrect.
Mm.
But how do we do as a nation and as journalists, if I can get my words out, journalists, how do we get the right information back to those people? Because there's a narrative, or there's always a narrative, isn't there? But how do you change that narrative?
I think it's just, you know, it's making sure that we go into work every day and telling ourselves that, you know, we need to be, you know, that trusted source, you know, of information.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to get things right, you know, you got to get things, you know, on air. You've got to make sure that you do your due diligence, and the more you do that, the more people will turn to you
for the facts. Yeah.
And I think, you know, with social media, and there's a lot of positive stuff from social media, but there is a hell of a lot of negative stuff, and, you know, and again, you know, some of the stories that we've covered recently, and this is a new phenomenon, you know, it didn't really exist even going back 5 years ago. But more often than not, when we were doing like a live presentation or my colleagues are reporting on the ground, you will have people who will turn up with their mobile phones, and as close as I am to you, they will hold their phones up and be filming you live, and then they'll turn around and do a piece of camera. So they're live streaming.
Wow.
You know, okay. And they're kind of challenging everything you're saying. They're saying that's nonsense. That, oh, you know, the mainstream media, don't believe what they're saying, all that kind of stuff, you know. So again, you know, like, we've always, you know, have the option of getting security, but now more than ever, we need security, because you have, you know, you've got random strangers coming up to you and telling you, you're part of the problem, mate.
It's true. But you see it on the news at lunchtime. Somebody will be doing an outside broadcast.
Yeah.
There'll be somebody with a sign behind them, or there'll be somebody shouting something.
Yeah.
And that has definitely become more of a thing. You do see people in the background with their phones.
Yeah.
It's become, I don't know, it's just really interesting how it's evolved. And that was one thing I was going to ask you was, from when you started to now, I mean, I'm not a journalist, but I've worked in social media, and I must admit, when I first started, it was very experimental. Yeah. Whereas now, I feel like you said, there's a lot of good when it comes to social media, but there's a lot of bad as well. And in some instances, it's been weaponized. Mm. And it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on how you've seen that evolve in terms of journalism. I know you've just touched on some of it now.
Yeah.
But it's definitely changed the landscape in so many ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, so there used to be, you know, a general idea that you kind of had sort of different cycles. You know, you had your morning cycle, and then that would take you up into the lunchtime news, and you'd have the afternoon cycle. Mm. You know, then you basically have, you know, your evening. So you'd have like kind of three big programs. You know, you'd have your lunchtime news, your evening news, and then your news at 10.
Yeah.
And everything was almost like built within that sort of window. But now, because of the emergence of social media, because of the emergence of Twitter, you know, news cycles could happen instantaneously. You know, a government minister decides to resign, you're not waiting straight for away. The lunchtime news. They put it out on Twitter, so you've got to react to it.
Yeah.
You know, so, but also you've got to make sure when tweets do go out or people are retweeting, you know, you've got it verified and you've done your due diligence. You've made sure you've done all your necessary checks, because once it goes out, it's out there. And if you, as ITV, are seen to have made the mistake, even if, you know, you got your facts from somebody else that you thought that they got everything, they dotted all the I's and crossed the T's, it feeds into a narrative, you know, that you're just the same as everybody else.
Right.
And we're not. You know, there's a team of people in every newsroom who spend a lot of time making sure that the information is correct.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and it's about credibility, and it takes years to build up credibility and to build up trust, but it takes seconds for that trust to come crumbling down.
Yeah.
You know, so again, you know, we always kind of factor that into the conversations that we're having as a team, as an editorial team, you know, because you've got to get it right.
Of course.
There's not second chances, and people can be quite unforgivable, understandably, as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I mean, so then in terms of the pressure that comes with that's a lot of pressure. So how do you and your colleagues, how do you deal with that? Because like you say, if you get that information wrong, there are repercussions for it, especially from a social media perspective. So how do you cope with that? Because I think that would be quite hard. Like, I do bits for my own business, I do interviews and all that kind of stuff, and even I, and it's information about me, I make sure it's fully researched. I don't get anything wrong, because I know if I do, you know, the ramification of that could be quite bad for me. So I can only imagine that the pressure is 100 times more for yourself.
Yeah, but I think, you know, as a journalist, and I look back to the days when I was first starting, you know, fact checking is just part and parcel of what you do.
Yeah, of course.
It's part of the job.
Part of being a journalist.
It's part of the job, you know, making sure that you've done everything you can, that the story's right. You know, even things like, you know, so if you watch our program, you know, we'll have what we call a super, which is basically a little strap which will identify who the person that we're speaking to is.
Yeah.
You know, and if you get a spelling mistake, you know, or you get something in that super wrong, it's kind of like, that's not good, guys.
No.
You know, we have to get things like that right, you know, and there's like a bit of like a mini inquest, you know, because it's fundamental to what we do.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if a slight little mistake, you know, it's like a leak. You know, if you make one mistake, you know, Monday, another mistake on Tuesday, Wednesday, it just builds and builds and builds. And it slowly chips away the credibility, you know. And then people will be like, well, why should we come to you when we can't really trust you, and you kind of keep on making these glaring errors? And also, you know, you want your viewers to be focused, have a laser focus on the story that you're covering and what we as presenters and we as reporters and correspondents are saying.
And delivering, you know, to,
And the minute you get something wrong, or the minute you get a fact wrong, you know, you can't blame your viewers. Be like, well, that's not right.
Yeah.
And then they'll be discussing with one another, sat on the sofa, going, they just said 50, but actually I'm sure it's like 200. And all of a sudden, They lose interest in what we are saying in the rest of the program, the rest of the report.
Yeah.
You know, so again, it goes back to the responsibility that you have. And, you know, we've only got our audience for half an hour every day.
So you've got to capture them.
So we've got to make sure. Yeah. And when we do get things wrong, then there is, and rightly so, there should be a bit of an inquest about why that happened in order to make sure that things like that never happen again in the future.
Yeah.
So looking ahead, Have you got any future goals? What do you want to do? Do you want to go into film? Do you want to be a footballer? Yeah, what do you want to do?
Well, do you know, when I hit 24, that's when I realised I was going to be a professional footballer. I always thought that, you know, I'd get spotted. Like, I used to play rugby as well back in the day, and I was like, I'd be in the park and I'd get a tap on the shoulders. Like, actually, you're right. You get to 24, 25, it's like, never going to happen. Stick to the day job. I don't know, I feel very blessed. I feel very privileged to be doing what I'm doing. It is a privilege, you know, people inviting me and my colleagues into their homes every single day.
Yeah.
And I don't take that responsibility lightly, you know, and it's a magazine type of program that we do. So you have the serious stuff at the top of the program. You have kind of like, you know, human interest feature kind of stories in the middle of the program. And you have like the lighter and finally sports or towards the end. So you can, there are different shades in the program and you can show different parts of your personality.
Yeah.
There's your authority, there's a Gamal, the news anchor, and then there's a Gamal Fateli, you know, who your nan wants to, you know, Fateli and stuff, you know. And I love it, you know, I really love it, especially when you can get to show your personality and have a bit of fun with your co-presenter and your other colleagues.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a really, really good, you know, gig that I've got. And I'm hoping to do it for as long as I humanly can. I think, but we live in a day and age where it's good to have, you know, a few other projects on the horizon.
Definitely.
You know, and to kind of diversify your portfolios. And what ITV is allowing us to do more, especially the on-screeners, is to do things like, you know, podcasts. And kind of like, you know, longer form documentaries, which I've kind of done quite recently as well. So, you know, I think kind of looking ahead to the future, along with my day job in inverted commas, it would be to, you know, work in those different areas where you get the opportunity to work a bit, you know, a bit more long form.
Yeah.
You can get to do podcasts because I think with our role, you know, because our reports can be so short, you know, there's so many interesting people that we've spoken to over the years that I'm like, we need like 40 minutes with this person, you know, to kind of really get under the skin of this, you know, get under the surface of this story, you know. So I think, as we move forwards, it'll be good to do more than, you know, more alongside what I'm doing.
Yeah, because I think at the minute, you know, for me, you're definitely an inspiration. You're on TV, and I think for a lot of young black kids and people of colour, if you like, to look up to see you every day, you know, between 5 and 6 or 6 and 7, whatever that time may be. It's a big thing, I feel. It's a massive thing. And I think, especially for young kids, and we all know about knife crime and all the stuff that's going on at the moment, they need someone who they can aspire to be, you know, and people like yourself. It's a big thing that you're on TV and you're showing people there's other ways that you can be. You don't have to go down that route. You can do what you do. Do you know what I mean? You can sit there in a tie. It's not that big a deal, you know. And I feel like for yourself, you know, if you can leave a legacy for the younger generation, you're doing well,
mate. I mean, again, you know, it's something that I think about all the time. You know, I know that in many ways I'm a role model, and I kind of wear that as a suit of armor. And a lot of what I do and a lot of my kind of psyche, my thinking, is to make it that bit easier for the next crop, the next cohort who are coming through.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and whatever I can do to get people on the journey and to make people think that this is a business for me, you know. And like, I remember when I was first starting, I might have told you about this, Lisa, you know, like my mum's first immediate thought when I told her I was going to be going to journalism, she was like, where can I find someone that knows Trevor McDonald? You know, and it's like, because he was the only black face I was on screen, in news.
I was saying this actually to my mum today, like, when I was younger, it was like Moira Stewart. It was like McDonald. It was certain, because you just didn't see a lot of black.
You didn't,
like, whenever I saw it, I would get so excited. I remember when I discovered Oprah, and I would watch that show every day. I was a kid. Yeah. I didn't necessarily know what they were talking about, but it was somebody that looked like me.
Yeah, it's important.
I think that's really important. And I think what's really great about you doing what you're doing and Len doing what he's doing is that there still exists a lot of negative narratives around black men specifically. And I think it's really great, like, when I see you on the news and it's like, you know what, here is a positive black role model for young black men and just black boys. I think that's really, really important, because even now, you know, there is still that narrative that exists, particularly around black men. And I think it's so, so important, especially in the age of fake news and misinformation, for for people that look like you to see somebody like you in a space that we still wouldn't usually occupy. Let's be honest. I think that's really, really important.
And you know, and I think like you know, you can't when you see, you know, men and women of colour in these kind of different positions, you can't help but thinking, you know, if somebody has made a mistake in some way, shape or form, a glaring error, whether it's a person or whatever, you can't help but thinking, don't mess it up, mate.
Don't mess it up. 100%.
Because it's not just about you. Because it's everyone. It's a bigger picture. Like, it's build a narrative, set a narrative, you know, and make people aspire to be you and aspire to be like you.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't, you know, there's, you know, I won't say names and stuff, but there've been, you know, a couple of stories recently where you just like.
Yeah.
What are you doing? I could say a couple of things as well, but I don't want to name anybody, but there's certain footballers done so well, you know, during the lockdown and made sure certain people were eating and all the, and then there was something in the press the other day that there was a load of fans outside. Mm. And he didn't sign anyone's.
Mm.
And there was a few black kids there that were there waiting for. He didn't sign anyone. I think that's so important.
Yeah.
That little thing, everything else that he'd done, he just thought, oh my God, mate, what have
it's
you done?
It's so important. Like, even
it's
me,
5 minutes, just sign it.
Just sign it.
Interviews or anything, like, even if it's just 2 minutes, I'm very conscious of the responsibility that that carries, regardless of the nature, whether it's a fun thing, whether it's a serious piece. I'm like, there's somebody out there that looks like me who might think, oh my God, well, if Lisa can do it, and even if they don't look like me, I think that's a responsibility. And I think now more so than ever, especially with social media, it's really important for us as people of colour, just people in general, to really remember that when you are representing, you're not just representing yourself.
Yeah.
I think that's a really, really important, because you might not even think about it. Like I did something for the BBC, I can't remember how long ago it was, and then somebody DM'd me on Instagram the other day saying, oh, I saw this interview you did, oh, it's really inspiring, I'd love to do stuff like this. And it just things I would never have thought about. And I think it's that thing for me, there's that weight of responsibility, and I never want to be kind of ignorant of that, if you like. I always want to bear that in mind, like I don't want to be irresponsible.
And you know, like, and I enjoy it. You know, I enjoy it. You know, I've always, you know, I've gone through my life, you know, even to this day, you know, like I'm a 42-year-old man, you know, and it's, I've always been like, I just want my parents to be proud of me.
Yeah,
you know, I want my mum and dad to be proud of me, you know, and I think that kind of gives me that kind of confidence to kind of keep doing what I'm doing. Everything is like, you know, deal my parents, you know, when they're, you know, with my uncles and aunties, so they feel proud of their Gamal and Miata, my sister, you know, and that kind of keeps me on course, you know, and then I think everything else falls, you know, just falls in line behind that. People see me as a role model, you know, because I conduct myself in a way that my parents want to conduct myself, you know. So, yeah, it's a privilege, you know, it can be hard, you know, and I think the older you get, the wiser you get, you know, you're not putting yourself in like compromising positions and all that kind of stuff, because you're not going out in the national, all that kind of stuff as much these days. So it does get a bit easier, but it's definitely not a burden. You know, for me, it's not. It's a privilege to be doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, you know? Fantastic. I have one final question before we let you go. And this is not to say that I believe in regrets or anything like that, because I don't. But throughout your career and throughout your life, if there was one thing that you could do differently, would you do it differently, or would you do everything exactly as you've done it? Because I sometimes think, I've made good decisions and I've done great things, but then maybe there's something, maybe if I could go back, I would tweak.
You can't change that though. Can't change the past.
If you could, anything that you've done where you think, maybe I could have handled that differently, or maybe I could have done more of this, because I do find myself thinking, you can't change the past.
No.
But if there was something you could do, even if it's just a small thing, is there anything? Or are you happy with everything you've done today, or you wouldn't change anything?
I wouldn't be so hard on myself.
Yeah.
I think I'm really self-critical, and I beat myself up. It's a personality thing. You know, I get into a bit of a hole with things, and I struggle to let it go.
Yeah.
You know, professionally and, you know, my personal life and stuff, and I think I cling on to things. And, you know, I think, especially doing this role, like a colleague years ago said to me, you know, as a presenter, you're almost like a porcelain doll, you know, you kind of look sort of shiny and all collected and, you know, well put together and stuff, you know, but it takes just a little chink, you know, and the cracks get bigger, and all of a sudden you've lost your confidence. So you've just got to be really mindful of that. That's what she said to me. And I kind of think that there have been times where I've really just kind of, you know, laboured on things that just in the grand scheme of things weren't very important, you know, and I think I just not be as tough on myself now.
Yeah.
You know, and just kind of go with the flow. Also, you know, maybe travelling. I was quite textbook. Like I did like university and then I went from university straight into, you know, I worked for those think tanks and then straight into journalism. And, you know, if I would go back, I had the opportunity to go travelling around the world and seeing different worlds and communities with my own eyes, I might have would have probably given that a go. But I think I was so laser focused, you know, about my career and the trajectory that I was on, that those areas of my life that could have been fascinating, you know, I maybe closed
still got
the door.
Time. Yeah,
still got time. Still got time. You know,
definitely.
But if I'm being reflective, you know, maybe it's that. But in the main, you know, I'm thrilled to bits. If I look back at the last 20 years of my life and stuff, you know, it's been a slog, but it's been worthwhile every bit of it.
Well, thank you so much for being our very first guest on the No Shortcuts podcast, Gamal. It's been a fantastic conversation.
That's
a
pleasure.
Thank you again.
Pleasure, guys.
Don't forget to when you become really famous.
We'll do this again.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been fantastic.
Cheers, guys.
I wish you the best for everything.
Thank you very much.
You take care. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gamal.
Nice one.